try to cover John 19, 20, and Star 21. I don't know how good we're going to do. John chapter 19, verse 31. The piercing of Jesus' side. The Jews, therefore, because it was the day of preparation, so that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, they asked Pilate that the legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. So it was the day of preparation. Friday was used to prepare for the Sabbath. This Sabbath was a high day because it was during the Passover week. Friday was the Passover. And so it was the Sabbath following a high feast. Saturday was the first day of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. It's the 7-day feast that follows Passover. This is spoken about Leviticus 23, verses 5 to 6. It's in the Jewish month of Nisan, which is March, about half of March and half of April, somewhere in there is when it occurs. The legs were broken. I'm glad you found that funny, Kurt. Most people the joke just went over everybody else's head. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, but the legs were broken. Remember, if you break the legs of the person, then the victim, then it's impossible for him to raise himself up and get a breath of air, and then death would come quickly. The Jewish legalism in this area, the Jews didn't mind killing an innocent man, even the Messiah, but they refused to break the Sabbath. And so they did not want the victims on the cross on the Sabbath. They thought it would make the Sabbath unclean. So they were more concerned about keeping the Sabbath the way they thought it should be kept, but killing an innocent man didn't bother them. The soldiers broke the legs of the two thieves in verse 32. Soldiers therefore came and broke the legs of the first man and of the other man who was crucified with him. Otherwise these guys could have lasted days on the cross, especially since these guys weren't whipped and received the tremendous beating that Christ received. They went to Jesus and he was already dead. Verse 33. But coming to Jesus, when they saw he was already dead, they did not break his legs. There was no sense in breaking his legs if he was already dead. However, the Roman soldier was a good, loyal Roman soldier, did his job right, so he had to verify or confirm that Jesus was dead. Verse 34. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately there came out blood and water. So the soldier confirmed that Jesus was dead. He pierced Christ's side. What he's basically doing is he's saying, okay, just in case he's not dead, I'll do something that would kill him. And so he gives him a lethal blow with a spear that would have killed him if Christ wasn't already dead. Now, when he pierced Christ's side, the flow of blood and water came out. Medical doctors tell us today that this is proof that Jesus was already dead. If just blood alone came out, it would flow out and it would prove that he was alive. But the spear apparently pierced the pericardium, which is the sac surrounding the heart. Okay? The spear apparently pierced both the pericardium and the heart itself. And so that this thing that appears to be blood and water, and just blood and a transparent liquid coming out, that's not, you only get that kind of scenario when a person is already dead. Now, Hugh Schoenfield and many others who is the Passover plot, and many guys who hold to some variations of the swoon theory, the idea that Jesus passed out on the cross, they took him down, but he was still alive. He regained consciousness in the tomb and somehow escaped or overpowered the Roman soldiers or whatever. The blood in the water clearly indicates that Jesus, the flow of blood and water, that he was dead. No if, what's, or buts about it. Now, the thing is, John, medical science had not proven this back then. So John might have thought it was a miracle, and maybe that's why he recorded it. But John wasn't recording it to try to, he didn't make it up to try to prove that Jesus died. He just reported what he saw. And now, 2,000 years later, it proves that Jesus was dead on the cross. John points out that he said, now, by the way, blood and water are the two main Old Testament symbols for cleansing and forgiveness. The cleansing by the blood and animal sacrifices, the forgiveness you receive through animal sacrifices are symbolic of the forgiveness you receive, and the water, the different cleansings. So blood and water are Old Testament symbols for cleansing and forgiveness. John mentions the blood and the water in 1 John 5:6. They were very important concepts to the Jews, and that might have been why John recorded it. But whatever reason he recorded it, it also serves as medical evidence that Jesus actually was dead on the cross. Verse 35, and he who has seen has borne witness, and his witness is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth so that you also may believe. So John is saying, I'm an eyewitness. This is what I saw. I've never seen blood and water flow from someone's side like that. But that's what I saw, and I'm telling it like it is, and I'm an eyewitness. Verse 36. For these things came to pass that the scripture might be fulfilled, not a bone of him shall be broken. They didn't break his leg. This was predicted in Exodus 34, verses 19 to 20. Psalm 34:19-20, that not a bone of his Holy One will be broken. Exodus chapter 12, verses 43-46, I believe it's talking about the Passover lamb, says that it's got to be a lamb without blemish, a lamb, you know, without any broken bones or anything. You don't take a lamb from your flock and say, I'll sacrifice this one to God. He's got two broken legs. He's not doing me any good. So that's not the way you offer sacrifice. You take the precious one, the lamb without blemish. And 1 Corinthians 5:7 says Jesus is our Passover lamb. So in order to be the Passover lamb, he could not have a broken bone. Verse 37, and again another scripture says, they shall look on him whom they pierced. Zechariah 12:10, or the second coming of Christ, the Jews will look on the one they pierced. Jesus Christ was pierced for our sins. He died on the cross for sin, and his side was pierced. Verses 38 to 42 talk about Jesus' burial. Verse 38, and after these things, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but a secret one for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate granted permission. He came, therefore, and took away his body. So Joseph Arimathea is a secret closet Christian, a secret disciple of Jesus. He's a wealthy man. He's a member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council of 70 members who rule over Israel. Of course, their power was limited by Rome at that time. And he was from Arimathea, a town 20 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And he asked Pilate for Jesus' body, and Pilate gave him permission. This is also mentioned in the other three Gospels as well, about that he owned the tomb, and it was a nearby tomb outside, a garden tomb that was outside Jerusalem. Isaiah 53:9 says that, you know, although he would be identified with sinners, you know, crucified with sinners, he would be buried with the rich, basically buried in a rich man's tomb. But it wasn't only Joseph Arimathea who was a secret disciple of Jesus, a closet Christian, also Nicodemus, another member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council. Verse 39, and Nicodemus came also, who had first come to him by night, bringing a mixture of myrrh and alloys, about 100 pounds weight. So Nicodemus was also a secret disciple of Jesus. He was a wealthy Pharisee, a member of the Sanhedrin. Remember, Jesus came to him at night, John chapter 3, verses 1 to 21, and told him, unless a man is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. John chapter 7, verses 45 to 52, they're talking about, you know, Jesus must be put to death, and Nicodemus speaks up and says, hey, we got to give this guy a trial. And they say, well, you're not one of his followers, are you? Don't you know that no prophet comes out of Galilee? But Jesus is given a royal burial. And this burial kept Jesus' body from being thrown into the valley of Hinnom, which is Gehenna, like most unclaimed prison criminals. If mom and dad don't come to pick up their son who just was crucified, rather than let the bodies hang up there, they would just take it down, take the corpse down. And the valley of Hinnom, Gehenna, leading into Jerusalem, was a garbage dump where the flames were kept running 24 hours a day. And Jesus used that, the Gehenna, as symbolic of the flames of hell. He said that all those who reject him will be thrown into Gehenna, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. You know, anybody can throw garbage into there and see worms in air, and they can see the flames are going 24 hours a day. Well, that's where the corpses of unclaimed criminals went. If Jesus was thrown in there, there would have been no way to verify the resurrection. So Jesus was buried, given a royal burial, and buried in a rich man's tomb. Verse 40, talk about the linen wrappings. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. These linen wrappings might have been the shroud of Turin, might have been part of it. Again, with the Jews, they didn't treat them like mummies. And wrap a guy from head to toe. Instead, they would tie like if you had a toothache, tie a towel, wrap a towel, roll it up, and wrap it around your face, to around your head to keep your mouth from opening. And then they would place two coins over the eyes. The coins that show up on the Shroud of Turin were from the coins from Pilate's reign, to keep your eyes from opening. Then they would tie your hands together to keep any reactions, to keep your hands from moving. And they would tie the feet together as well. Then they would take a shroud and wrap it over you. I'll just throw it on the back side and look like that. Right? And they wrap this cloth all the way around your front and your back. And those were the grave clothes. That's why you can see just from looking at how much trouble Lazarus would have had coming out of the tomb. Okay? But those are the linen cloths and the linen wrappings that the Jews used to wrap people in. They found many skeletons like that. Verses 41 to 42. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had been laid. Therefore, on account of the Jewish day of preparation, because the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. And so there was a tomb near Jerusalem. They rushed. They couldn't work on the Sabbath. And so they buried Christ in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. Now, the soldiers were at the tomb. They guarded the tomb. They're mentioned in Matthew 27, verses 62 to 66. Pilate grants permission for the soldiers to guard the tomb. And a Roman guard would be made up of four soldiers, so there's probably four soldiers guarding the tomb, if I remember correctly.
What were the verses again?
Matthew 27, 62 to 66. Okay, now lead us into John chapter 20, which gives us evidence for the resurrection of Christ. John chapter 20. If you look at verses 1 and 2.
Real quick.
Yeah.
What was the basis for station on the guard?
Because
the apostles couldn't steal bodies.
Is that what the Jews were afraid of?
Yeah, because they said that he predicted his resurrection and the apostles might steal the body and the deception would be worse than at first. And the funny thing was, the Pharisees remembered that Jesus predicted he would die and would rise. His own followers didn't remember that until later on. It was, and it's kind of interesting. But evidence for the resurrection is given in John chapter 20, verses 1 to 18. In fact, it's given throughout this chapter. But the empty tomb is mentioned in verses 1 to 10. Look at verses 1 and 2 of John chapter 20. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early to the tomb while it was still dark and saw the stone already taken away from the tomb. And so she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Now Mary Magdalene, is mentioned right here. It was Sunday, the first day of the week. And Mary Magdalene, again, is mentioned in Luke 8, 1 and 3. Jesus cast 7 demons out of her. She was one of the ladies that was supporting Christ. I like whenever they have a movie and Mary Magdalene is wiped at the feet of Jesus and all with her hair. Then what it is that you're saving money because a woman did do that, but it wasn't Mary Magdalene, and at least the scriptures don't say that it was, because don't forget, there's two ladies that wiped the feet of Jesus, one with the perfume and the other with her tears. The one with the perfume was one of the sisters of Lazarus. The one with her tears, that lady was a prostitute that was repenting and coming to Christ. And nowhere, Mary Magdalene got seven demons cast out of her, but nowhere does it say that Mary Magdalene was ever a prostitute or that she was the one who did that to Jesus. But again, if you're in Hollywood and you've got, why pay for two actresses when you can make them the same person and then just pay one? So that's what they do, but we have no knowledge of Mary Magdalene doing that. But she came early to the tomb while it was still dark. She was very dedicated. Most of us like to stay in bed late whenever possible. But she came very early to the tomb while it was still dark. And she came with, actually came with other women. Luke 24:10 tells us that. And she came with spices to anoint Christ's body, according to Mark 16:1. Because, you know, the burial was rushed. And so she had some more spices. She wanted to finish the burial. She figured, I put my faith in him. He was a godly man, a prophet of God. I believe he was the Messiah. He's worth it. And I don't care if the world considers him a shameful criminal. I'm going there to anoint his body. And so she goes to anoint the body, and then she finds that the stone was already moved. Now the way the tombs were over there, I think most of us know, we've seen enough movies and Hollywood hasn't done too bad in this area. Most of the tombs were just either caves or man-made caves where the an opening has been cut out of the rock. And what they do is they'll get a big stone. It'll be cut in such a way that they can roll it in there, and they'll have it set up so there's a little slope in front of the opening. So the rock, one or two guys, and they just push it, and it rolls into this area, and then it covers the opening. Okay? Now it only takes one guy to just push it downhill. But to get that baby open, it's going to take quite a group of strong people to push it out. That's why the ladies were wondering if they were going to have somebody give them a hand. And probably the Roman soldiers. You probably ask these strong Roman soldiers to help you. They probably just ridicule you and start making wisecracks at you or whatever. But anyway, the stone was already moved. A circular stone of several tons. Took several men to open it. A lot easier to close it. But remember, the stone was not moved to let Jesus out. Jesus, probably, he could appear and disappear. You know, he didn't go through walls to visit the apostles in the upper room. He just appeared in the room. I believe he's traveling at the speed of thought. And so, when he rose from the dead, he probably just, boom, he was in an instant, was risen and was out of the tomb somewhere else. There was the earthquake and all, and when the stone was rolled away, the angels announced that Jesus had risen, but Jesus wasn't even there. So keep that in mind. The stone was moved to let the disciples in. It was not moved to let Jesus out. Now there it says, look where she tells, came to Simon Peter and them and said, we do not know where they have laid him. She's talking about the other ladies that she came with, and that again is mentioned in Luke 24:10. But she thought Christ's body had been removed by others. Verses 3 and 10 show how Peter and John respond. Let's look at verse 3. Peter therefore went forth and the other disciple, and they were going to the tomb. So both immediately left for the tomb. We're going to find out that they actually ran to the tomb. Verse 4, And the two were running together, and the other disciple ran ahead faster than Peter and came to the tomb first. So John outruns Peter. John is probably much younger than Peter. He outlived Peter by a long time. And he gets there first. But John looks into the tomb, but he didn't enter it. Verse 5, and stooping and looking in, he saw linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. Verse 6, Peter enters the tomb. Simon Peter therefore also came following him and entered the tomb and beheld the linen wrappings lying there. So Peter enters the tomb, he sees the linen wrappings, probably the wrappings from that I described as where we find on the Shroud of Turin. Verse 7, and the face cloth which had been on his head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. So the face cloth, that like thing that goes around you, like if you got a toothache, was rolled up and by itself. Okay, then John enters in verse 8. So the other disciple who had first come to the tomb entered then also, and he saw and believed. So now right here, it appears that John sees and believes that Jesus has risen. I mean, what else would there be to believe at this point? So he looks on in and he says, forget this, man. And nobody took him out. The dude rose. My Messiah, my Savior, my friend, my teacher, my rabbi, he rose from the dead. They killed him, but he rose. Still, the apostles overlooked the Old Testament prediction in Psalm 16:10, verse 9. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. So in other words, it took John to see this evidence in the tomb for him to recognize that Jesus would rise, that Jesus had risen. Even though in Psalm 16:10, David predicts that God would not allow his Holy One to see decay. He would not allow the corpse of his Holy One to rot, but he would raise him before that point. Now, probably what they were looking at was that the grave clothes had probably not been unwound, okay? They were probably, you know, they get hardened. Grave clothes get hardened by the spices and all. And so what you probably have is it laying there open like a cocoon, and there's no body in there. And you know, this stuff is tied real tight. I mean, the whole purpose is to keep, you know, nervous reactions. And you know, people in coffins have been known at times to just sit up in the coffin if they haven't been embalmed. You know, in older days they used to just sit up and stuff from a nervous reaction. And so you want to prevent that kind of a thing. And so here they look, and it's like, there is no way that body could have been stolen. Now, they found the face cloth folded up on the side. So it's like Jesus just kind of moved right through it or whatever, came out of it, and then took it off, folded it neatly down. But just from looking at that cocoon type thing, it became really obvious to the apostles that you don't steal something. Number one, a thief doesn't steal a body and then fold up a cloth real nice. That's number one. But number two, you probably got the cocoon shape to it, which means it's impossible to have removed the body, humanly speaking, and leave everything else intact.
Besides, if you're going to steal the body, you just pick it all up and grab it.
Yeah, yeah. It'd make it a lot easier for you, too.
That's the point.
What's that?
That's the point.
The coins would have dropped right there.
You need a soda.
And, Doug, you've been sitting next to Kurt too long.
It probably wouldn't be easier to leave us and take all that stuff with you, because that's what.
Well, it would be heavy. It probably would be heavy.
If they were to take it off, they'd like cut it off or something. Anyway,
yeah. And so it was left in. That's probably. By the way, in Luke 24:12, it says that Peter was amazed when he saw, you know, the face cloth rolled up as if Jesus' head was still in it, possible. Maybe he took it apart and then folded it real nice, whatever. But Jesus' body had apparently passed through the grave clothes, And obviously, these would not have left the grave clothes in that state. And that's why John saw and believed it was pretty evident that his Messiah and his rabbi had risen from the dead. Verse 10 of John chapter 20, so the disciples went away again to their own home. So now they return home. Now the risen Lord appears in verses 11 to 18. Take a look at verse 11. But Mary was standing outside the tomb weeping, and so as she wept, she stooped and looked into the tomb. So Mary wept and looked into the tomb. In the Greek, it's saying that she wept loudly. I mean, she was really, really weeping. She loved the Lord. Yes, he died a shameful death, but she wanted him to have an honorable burial. Okay, she's thinking, somebody stole the body. I wanted him to have an honorable burial. He was a great man, a great prophet. I believe he was a Jewish Messiah. I loved him. He died such a shameful death. He deserved to die that way. He deserved an honorable burial. That's such a shame that some jerk out there stole the body. Now Mary sees two angels in white in verse 12. Take a look at verse 12. And she beheld two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet where the body of Jesus had been lying. So she sees two angels in white sitting in the tomb, one at the head and the other at the feet where Jesus' body had been. By the way, John calls them two angels. Matthew calls them one angel. Mark calls them a young man. And Luke calls them two men in Luke 24, verse 4. But then he calls them angels in verse 23. In other words, no contradiction. The angels took bodily form and appeared as men. They were angels, but you could call them men because they appeared as men. So there's no problem there. And the fact that Matthew says one angel came, it'd be like if Kurt and Doug came up to me and said, Phil, your message was off the wall. We checked it out in the scriptures, and it was unbiblical. And let's say Kurt and Doug came up to me and said that, but Kurt was the only one who said it. But Doug was standing there saying, yep, he's right, yep. If I go home and tell my wife that Kurt came up to me and said my message was heretical, I wouldn't be lying. And if you went home and told my wife that Kurt and Doug both came up to me and said that, you wouldn't be lying either. I find this all the time when I used to do investigations at the sub-base police at Bangor. People who aren't lying, but one guy will say, well, two guys came up and beat him up. Another guy will say, well, one guy came up and beat him up. And then when I sit them both out, I say, well, no, wait a minute here. There's a contradiction here. It ends up, well, no. Well, one guy was pushing him, but the other guy was doing all the punching. He was leaving all the bruises on him. That guy beat him up. The other guy just pushed him a little bit. He really wasn't in as much as the other guy. So, yeah, you could say both guys beat him up or one guy beat him up. It wouldn't be a contradiction. Now, if he said one guy only and no other, then you'd be talking a contradiction.
So, did John and Peter, they took off again and went home, but they didn't let Mary on this, on what they had decided? So she appears to still not know.
No, it's pretty much... And it's a lot of times, it's a general statement, they'll make an actual rule out of it, but it's why more guys study theology than ladies. Ladies tend to make more decisions emotionally than women are too sensitive, but men aren't sensitive enough. Men are too rational sometimes, and sometimes women aren't rational enough. So none of us are perfect. We're too far on one extreme, they're too far on the other extreme. Mary's just weeping. I mean, she's just having a big emotional experience here. She's not even thinking about whether or not thieves would have left the grave clothes like that. Peter and John, there's no crying at all. I mean, their Messiah was just killed 3 days earlier, and they're not even crying. But they're looking at the grave clothes, and they're rationalizing, thinking that it's kind of like when the man born blind. Instead of having a little bit of sensitivity and compassion for the guy that was born blind, they're asking Jesus philosophical questions. Whose sin was it? His in the womb or his mother's? Or his parents that caused him, you know.
Right.
So they were rationalizing the whole thing, trying to figure it out. She just wanted a good burial. It was like, first they give him a horrible, shameful death, and now he just blew his funeral right out of the water, and I wanted him to have such an honorable burial and stuff. What a great man, the Jewish Messiah, and look what they did to him. So she was more in an emotional state. They were rationalizing the whole thing. And anyway, about the angels asked Mary why she was weeping. Verse 13. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." By the way, we mentioned this earlier too about Jesus having so many woman followers and being willing to teach women. Most Jewish rabbis refused to teach women. And, you know, that was a big slap in the face to any male chauvinist pig who has that type of view. Jesus said, you know, "Come to me all who weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest." And he meant both men and women. And the Jewish religious leaders, the Jewish rabbis who would not, even the apostles. Here Jesus was talking to a Samaritan whom Jews were prejudiced against, and the woman happened to be an immoral woman, and Jesus was talking to her at the well, and the apostles, the only thing they could think of was, they were wondering, why in the world is he talking to a woman? And it's like, what's wrong with talking to a woman? But that's how pig-headed and prejudicial the Jewish mindset was at that day. A wife was considered property of her husband. But Jesus Christ was not like that. And he considered woman very important, and he had no problem teaching woman. And there was a lot of women very receptive to his ministry and that supported his ministry. So verse 13, and he asked her why she was weeping, and then she said, "Because they took away the Lord," and she didn't know where they laid him. So her response was that, they took Jesus' body, she doesn't know where it is. Now, verses 14 to 18, Jesus appears to Mary. In verse 14, when she had said that, she turned around and beheld Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. So she saw Jesus but didn't recognize him. Now, the Bible teaches it was the same Jesus. He didn't take on a different body. He had the same body, but it was glorified. It was given some powers that it didn't have before. So this is the same Jesus. So there's either a natural reason why she didn't recognize him or a supernatural reason why she didn't recognize him, okay? Now, it could have been the tears. Yeah, she could have been crying so much that everything was just blurred. It could have been, you know, let's face it, if you attended somebody's funeral a few days ago, you certainly do not expect to see them alive again 3 days later. Another thing could be, that Jesus was, he was battered so bad that she probably assumed if she ever did see him again, his body would be in that battered state. And though he had still had the holes in his hands and feet and the pierced side, he was no longer in a battered state. Another thing is he could have wear a hood. You know, there's a lot of different things. It was probably light by this point, but how light, you know, we don't know. But there could be natural explanations, or it could have been supernatural. God could have just prevented her supernaturally from recognizing who Jesus was at that point. Now, Jesus asked her why she was weeping, verse 15. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." So Jesus asked her why she was weeping. Mary, at this point, thinks it's the gardener. She asked him if he's taken the body. She wanted to take custody of Jesus' body and give him the proper burial that she thought he deserved.
Probably wasn't glorified. I mean, was the gardener.
Yeah.
What was that?
He probably wasn't standing there glorified if she thought he was the gardener.
Well, there's different degrees of glorification. He was glorified just the fact that he's risen from the dead and has an immortal body. That means a certain level of glorification right there. For instance, glorification there would entail he has a body that would never die again. But the different degrees of glorification would probably reach its fulfillment when he ascended to the Father's right hand. But he's glorified in the sense that he's has his glorification body so that it will never die again. He doesn't need to eat food to sustain his bodily existence. He can eat food for pleasure, but he doesn't have to eat food to keep himself going. Jesus calls Mary by her name in verse 16. Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, Rabboni, which means teacher. So Jesus called Mary by her name, and she now recognized him. You know, there's something about somebody you really, really love. There's something about the way they say your name. You know? And, you know, I've had buddies, I've had Oriental buddies in the past. They used to call me Theo. You know, instead of Phil, they can't say Phil, so they say Theo. And some of these guys were very, very loyal, good friends. You know, they would die for you. And there's something special about the way they say my name. And some guy used to call me the Marine Corps Dave Aliano, Italian from Boston. He used to call my nickname was Ferno. And but he used to call me Fernie. And he was the only guy that called me Fernie. At that time I wouldn't let people call me that except Aliano. Aliano, me and him were real close, and he called me Fernie. He used to say he was crazy. I wasn't crazy, but he was crazy. This guy took a shotgun in the Marine Corps and blew a hole in the wall in the guardhouse on a dare. And almost got kicked out of Marine Corps boot camp because they found out he shot his cousin on a dare with a .22 in the leg. And so he was a real nut. And he got busted in a hockey game. He was watching a pro hockey game and he started a fight in the stands and had gotten busted. And he lied about this when he enlisted in the Marine Corps. But anyway, Aliano, he was crazy. I wasn't, but he used to call me Crazy Fernie, like that. And he'd talk like that and say Fernie. And there's something about the way that your close friends call your name. She didn't recognize him, but then when he called her by her name, she knew. When he called her by her name, she knew who he was. This was her Jesus. This was her rabbi. Her master, her teacher. This is the guy. You know, she was probably starving. Everybody, we have some ladies right here just sitting through lectures. Most ladies don't like theological lectures, you know. Most ladies, you know, they like to sit around and talk with each other and do things for the church, and they do so many nice things, but very few ladies like to sit down and listen to hours upon hours of boring theology. But she was one of Mary's one of those special ladies that liked to sit down and listen to theology. But most people would still find them boring. You're one of those weird people. Don't ruin my argument here.
Feminist Christology still? I've been reading feminist
Christology. Praise God! Oh, no, you said it!
I thought I'd get slammed if I did.
That's a whole different thing there. You're talking about non-believers. There's some feminist theologians that are actually true believers, but they got some warped theology. In case anybody doesn't know, feminist theologians are the ones that are turning the God of the Bible into a she, and they're doing a real lot of damage in a lot of different areas, but we don't have time to get into that. But what I'm getting at here is there probably wasn't a rabbi in all Israel that would have been willing to teach this lady or any of the other ladies that Jesus taught. So here she found a rabbi who would teach her, and lo and behold, he turned out to be the Jewish Messiah. It was like Jesus saying, the good shepherd knows his sheep by name and lays down his life for the sheep. When Mary heard Jesus speak her name, she recognized him. She knew that was her rabbi, her master, her teacher. And then Jesus tells Mary to stop clinging to him. Verse 17, Jesus said to her, "Stop clinging to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I ascend to my Father and your Father, and my God and your God." So, once she recognized that this was Jesus and he was alive again, she got him in such a death hold. She got him in such a bear hug that he realized, hey, I'm not going to get any of my work done for my Father right now. I mean, I can't do anything with this woman hanging on to me. I mean, it's going to be pretty tough to appear to the apostles when this woman doesn't go through walls like I do. And So, you know, this could become a problem. But she loved Jesus so much, she was just going to hold on to him, and she was pretty much saying, they'll never get you again because I ain't letting go of Jesus. And so he tells her to stop clinging to him. Now, he rose bodily, and the Jehovah's Witnesses like Jesus to be a spirit, but how Mary could be hugging a spirit, I don't know. But Jesus bodily rose from the dead. He predicted in John chapter 2, 19-21, destroy this temple, I'll raise it up in 3 days. They thought he was talking about the temple in Jerusalem, but John said he was talking about the temple of his body. There was a body to cling to. And the word there, haptomai, in the Greek means to take hold of, to cling to. Jesus was not opposed to being touched. Okay? Luke 24, verse 39, he appears to the apostles and he says, come on, you guys want some evidence? Touch the holes in my hands. Touch the holes in my feet. Touch my pierced side. He wasn't opposed to being touched. So what he was saying was, he was telling her, look, stop holding me back. Stop restraining me. Because I must report to the Father soon. Now this is not what we call the ascension. He's not, all ascending means is to go up. I don't think he's talking about when he ascended to heaven 40 days later. He's not saying, stop holding me, I've only got 40 days until I ascend to heaven. I think what he's saying is that he was going, traveling at the speed of thought. Right there he was by her, but now he needed to be to report to the Father's presence. And so he was going to think, okay, I'll be in the Father's presence, and boom, he was going to be there. But he can't do that with this woman clinging to him and holding him so tight. So this is probably just his first bodily visit to heaven after his death. Okay, Jesus only appeared maybe 10 or 11 times during those 40 days. He wasn't, you know, when he wasn't appearing to the apostles, he wasn't hiding under a stairway, looking out, making sure nobody sees him and this and that. Those times that he wasn't appearing to the apostles or the 500 witnesses that saw him or to James or to Peter, he was probably in the Father's throne room. So, but the ascension was when he slowly, his body slowly ascended into heaven. Until he left the apostles' sight, and then he probably went immediately into the Father's presence, and that was to show them that I'm not going to come back and appear to you guys on a regular basis like I've done before. My ministry on earth is done.
But yeah. Where it says, "For I've not yet returned to the Father," if somebody uses that, like for instance, when they're during the 3 days that he was dead. Mm-hmm. Okay, we talked about that before, where what he was dead is in the Father's presence.
Yeah.
But if somebody used this to say, well, it can't be because he says right here, for I have yet to return to the Father, how do you repeat that?
Real easy. When he's on the cross, he said, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. So he was saying his spirit was immediately going to go into the Father's presence. Here he says, I have not yet ascended to my Father. Ascended here has with it the idea of bodily ascending to heaven. In other words, I haven't, since I have risen from the dead, I have not yet reported to my Father. So the other one is talking about the spirit going to the Father's presence while the body remains in the tomb. The other one is saying, now that my spirit and body are joined together again, I have not yet reported to the Father. So there's a distinction between the two. I think it's a real clear distinction. I get up. Let's close this lecture. I'll